From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The 1964 novel Last Exit to Brooklyn offered a bleak vision of a loveless world. The novel's brutality, violent sex, and explicit language made it the subject of obscenity trials. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Hubert Selby Jr. He's the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, which has just been made into a film. Also today, we examine the mind of a cultured killer. He's the subject of a new novel by the Irish writer John Banville. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two never-before-released works by Kurt Weill. And we have a reading from poet Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. South African President F.W. de Klerk and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela emerged today from 3 days of talks they say will clear the way for power-sharing negotiations. The two leaders agreed to consider compromising on key positions. Mandela is promising to rethink ANC support of guerrilla warfare, and de Klerk says he'll move to lift the 4-year state of emergency. Brushing off warnings of economic hardship and Soviet unrest, the Soviet Baltic Republic of Latvia followed Lithuania today and declared its renewal as a sovereign state independent from Moscow. The vote, orchestrated by the Latvian Popular Front, barely beat back the stern objections of a strong Russian minority. Benjamin Rowe reports from Riga.
The declaration states that the Soviet government's military aggression, occupation, annexation, and liquidation of Latvian statehood were international crimes and are therefore invalid. Instead, it says that the 1922 Latvian constitution is still in effect. But in a gesture to Moscow, the declaration calls for a transition period for the reestablishment of de facto independence of Latvia, during which all parts of the Soviet constitution that do not abrogate Latvia's sovereignty will remain in effect. The often acrimonious debate was finally closed by an emotional speech by Popular Front deputy Maverick Wolfson. He accused the bill's opponents of being more conservative than Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, who, he asserted, was prepared to let Latvia go. But 57 conservative deputies boycotted the roll call vote in a last-minute bid to derail the independence declaration. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Riga, Latvia.
The Israeli government has denied a report that one of its Navy patrol boats opened fire on Jordanian King Hussein's yacht. Patricia Golan has this report on Israel's perspective.
Shares with the Israeli resort town of Eilat. The report, which surfaced today in an Israeli daily, said an Israeli naval vessel fired at Hussein's yacht while the monarch was standing on deck in full view. The report said that after the first shots were fired, Hussein took over command of his yacht and headed for Saudi and Arabian waters, all the time being fired at by the tailgating Israeli vessel. An Israeli military spokesman acknowledges the Navy knew the king's yacht was in the vicinity. Says the gunboat was conducting a routine weapons check by firing off a round of ammunition in a direction where there were no other boats. The spokesman said the Israeli Navy has clear standing orders on rules of conduct when Hussein's yacht is in the bay. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, computerized program buying and a rally in the bond market helped push prices higher at the close. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 14 points to close at 2710.19. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in moderate trading of 141 million shares. This is NPR News. A computer hacker was sentenced to 3 years probation and fined $10,000 today for creating a so-called worm program that crippled thousands of computers across the country. Robert Morris, a former Cornell University graduate student, was also ordered to perform 400 hours of community service. Morris could have been sentenced to as much as 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000. The computer program that Morris unleashed in 1988 reportedly paralyzed as many as 6,000 computers, including some at NASA, military bases, and major universities. There was more testimony today on charges of political favoritism in the Reagan administration's Department of Housing and Urban Development. As NPR's Mara Liasson reports, the witness was a HUD official convicted of corruption charges.
Du Bois Gilliam is a former top aide to former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce. Gilliam is currently serving an 18-month sentence on bribery and conspiracy convictions. He told a congressional panel today that Secretary Pierce directed HUD grants to friends. One was a friend who had managed an unsuccessful campaign for a New York State judgeship for Pierce. Gilliam also told the panel he helped steer a grant to another group because it had connections to Pierce's brother. Gilliam's testimony contradicts statements Pierce made before the committee last May. At that time, Pierce said he was a hands-off manager who was not directly involved in deciding who got HUD grants. Pierce's attorneys have questioned Gilliam's credibility, calling him an admitted cheat and liar. The congressional panel has been investigating influence peddling and favoritism at HUD for almost a year. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The retired commander of the USS Iowa said today that the Navy bungled its investigation of the gun turret explosion that killed 47 sailors aboard the battleship last year. Captain Fred Musali charged that investigators paid too much attention to the Navy's image and gave too much credence to unsubstantiated information. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new movie adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn, the 1964 novel by my guest Hubert Selby Jr. Last Exit is a collection of stories about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. The characters are brutal. Their stories are hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. Time magazine called it Grove Press's extra special dirty book for fall. Last Exit was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England. It was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. Hubert Selby has written other novels, but his first remains the one he's best known for. The new movie is directed by German filmmaker Uli Edel. Selby was a consultant and stayed on location for the shoot. The stories are set in the slums around Brooklyn's waterfront, where Selby hung out in 1949. I asked him to describe the area.
Well, it was, at the time, it was the New York port of embarkation. They used to call it the Brooklyn Army Base. And it subsequently has been closed, and it's now being turned into office space. But that operated all through the Second War and the Korean War. And tons of troops and material and equipment was shipped from the army base overseas to Europe. And, of course, there was a lot of Navy personnel there as well. And it was like any neighborhood waterfront area. There was a lot of violence, an incredible amount of violence.
Were you ever beaten up when you were living in that area?
I never lived in that area.
You're just hanging out there.
Yeah, just hanging out. And was I ever beaten up there? No, I don't think I was.
I figure you were probably fairly weak at the time because you had TB when you were a little bit younger. And as a result of the TB and some surgery that they performed on you in an attempt to cure the TB, you were probably in a weakened state. And I was wondering if that left you in a position in which you were easily picked on, if it left you in a position where you felt likely to be victimized.
No, I was in a weakened state. I mean, I had 10 ribs cut out, and there was, there was nothing left but an oil slick. And I was actually in between hospital stays when I was down there. But I don't think I've ever been picked on in my entire life, to tell you the truth. I may have felt like I was. I think every kid does in school or what, so forth. But I don't know that I've ever been picked on before or after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no problem when I was hanging out down there. As a matter of fact, I think what happened and what had happened in other areas after the surgery was that people tend to take care of me more. They look out for me. So rather than pick on me, they kind of protect me.
I think one of the best-known characters from your novel is Georgette, who you describe as a hip queer. He's a homosexual, but often dresses in drag and is described as a she in the book. Who is the character based on?
Well, there was a young guy named Georgie that lived in the neighborhood, and I didn't understand my relationship to Georgie at the time, but I realized subsequently that I had a very deep and profound affection and compassion for Georgie, and in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing the book. And that came about to anticipate a question. I wrote the first part of a section of Last Exit called The Queen is Dead. I wrote the first part of that story, and I called it Love's Labor's Lost, and that was published in the Black Mountain Review. And a year or two later, I met someone from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the streets, literally in the gutter, and evidently died of an OD. And as I said, I didn't understand the emotions behind this at the time, but I knew I had to finish the story. I could not allow Georgie to have died, especially such a humiliating death, without doing something for him. I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn. And when they suggested I play the role of the car driver in the movie that hits Georgette and kills her, it just seemed absolutely perfect for me because it seemed poetic, too, that I would be, in a sense, killing Georgie when I brought Georgie to life in the book and then subsequently on the screen, and that finally, hopefully, Georgie can be put to rest and find the dignity that all life deserves.
Did any readers assume that you were either gay or a transvestite after reading either the story, The Queen is Dead, or Last Exit to Brooklyn?
As I understand it, most people assumed I was gay. And also, a friend of mine told me a very interesting story. He was talking with a black friend of his, and he said that this friend of his assumed I was black because I had depicted black people so well. So I guess I'm a black, gay, homosexual queen or something.
I had heard from someone that your publishers wanted you to pose with your wife just so readers would know he's not a homosexual.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. I think somebody interviewed me and suggested that we do that, have a picture in whatever magazine that was. And if I remember correctly, I said, no, that gay people buy books. Let's not scare them off. I'd forgotten that. That's true.
So they went for that, huh?
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know, but they went for it or not.
There's no redemption in the book in the sense that, you know, people don't see the light and change their ways and so on. In fact, some of the most interesting people are the ones who get killed. But each chapter of Last Exit to Brooklyn starts with a quote from the Bible.
The Old Testament.
Were you religious at the time you wrote it?
Not in the sense of organized formal religion, no.
But in another sense?
I think of it more in a spiritual sense, not a religious sense.
Mm-hmm. And Christian?
Hmm?
Are you a Christian?
Oh, am I a Christian?
Yeah.
As far as I know, no.
Okay.
I have no intention of being one.
And has that sense, that spiritual sense, but outside of organized religion, increased or decreased as the years have gone on?
Well, I don't think it can increase because I think we're nothing but spiritual beings. But my awareness of it and my conscious contact with it has increased.
Mm-hmm. Hubert Selby Jr. is my guest. And I want to ask you, now that I'm reintroducing you by name, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure. But when you have a name like Hubert, and you're... And you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at you and say, Hubert, Hubert. You know, you have to do something to survive. And at one point when I was maybe 10 years old, in that area, someplace, I was on a team called the Bear Cubs. And the only connection I can see between the nickname Cubby and some event in my life is that. So maybe from that came the name Cubby. I don't know, but I am eternally grateful. And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
Okay, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
And my guest is Hubert Selby Jr., and his first novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, has just been made into a movie. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Hubert Selby Jr., and his novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, has just been made into a film. How did you start to write? You dropped out of high school.
Well, I don't know if I went to high school.
Oh, really?
Well, I did finish the ninth grade. I guess that's high school.
My neighborhood, it was junior high.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I left at 15. I started to write because I was taken off a ship in Germany when I was 18. They said I couldn't live more than 2 months. And I've been given up for dead many times. And I just didn't want to waste my life. I had what I now realize was a spiritual experience. And what happened was I knew that someday I would die. And just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. And number two, I would want to live my life over again, and then I would die. And that terrified me. As I say, it was a spiritual experience. And, you know, as you know, those experiences are far more profound than any experience we can have at this level of consciousness. And to think that I would live my entire life, look at it, and say, oh, I blew it, was such a terrifying thought that I bought a typewriter. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I bought a typewriter because I had no ideas or anything else. But that is what got me to start writing, was I did not want to waste my life. I wanted to, and I had to do something with my life.
Well, writers like Richard Price have credited you with giving them the sense that the stories in their neighborhood, that the language that they and their friends used could be the language of literature. What gave you the idea that your stories and the kind of street language that you used or that people around you used could be the stuff of literature?
Well, when I started to write, I knew I had to write about something I knew, that I couldn't just invent a whole new thing like science fiction or whatever. I knew that wasn't my area, my shtick. And I was just guided and directed from, again, this inner source, this creator of life, whatever it is that exists within all of us. And I certainly didn't define it as such at the time, but everything else was put out of my mind, and my mind only focused on certain things. And so every night for the next 6 years, I came home from work, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. Some nights I'd get one word, some nights two words. But every night for 6 years, I worked on this book, and that was the only thing that was given to me to write, was those experiences.
What kind of job did you have at that time?
Oh, most of those years, I worked in an insurance agency. I calculated and administered pension plans and group insurance plans.
Were you any good at it?
Very, very good.
What kind of family did you come from? Were they poor, middle class?
Middle class. I was born just before the Depression, and I had nothing to do with that, believe me. It wasn't my fault. So I don't know what kind of middle class there was from 29 to 39, but whatever it was, that's where we were.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
Oh, I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I knew I didn't have whatever it takes to go to school. And in many ways, that's true, I didn't. I couldn't do it. I had to go. I had to go.
So you went and you worked on the waterfront. What was the experience like for you, and were you exposed to the kind of violence and corruption that you've written about?
Not really. I wasn't. It was a job. I worked on tugboats. I worked on launches. I worked on dredges, and then I went to sea on Liberty ships, and I wasn't exposed to it in that sense. And I loved it. I've always wanted to go to sea. If I hadn't gotten sick, I might still be going to sea. I just loved it. I love everything about the water.
Well, when you were 18, you signed on to a freighter. And that's when you got tuberculosis, right?
Well, actually, I had been sailing on freighters for a couple of years at that point.
I see.
I started, I guess I was 15 or 16 the first time I sailed to Europe. And it was just after my 18th birthday when I was taken off the ship in Germany.
With tuberculosis?
Correct.
Now, if I have this straight, the therapy that they used for you, because you were very sick, was the doctors deflated one lung, took out part of your other lung,
mm-hmm.
and then removed 10 ribs. Why did they remove 10 ribs?
Well, they cut 8 ribs out on one side to collapse that lung permanently. And they cut a couple of ribs out on the other side to cut the piece out of the lung. And they had used an experimental drug to keep me alive. And that impaired my vision and my hearing, and my inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk. I'd fall down, and all my muscles were petrified from the drug. So it was kind of a mess.
Was this all experimental therapy at the time?
No. The surgery and everything was not experimental. It was, one of the few ways they had of dealing with a situation as advanced as mine.
So you've been permanently weakened, I guess, by the experience, but lucky that you survived.
Yeah, I'm a survivor. I'm tenacious. I've had 4 different doctors in the last couple of years say to me that 2 doctors in Germany and 3 doctors here in this country have said to me that according to all accepted medical evidence, I'm a dead man.
Huh. You got hooked on morphine from the hospitalization experience after the TB and the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any medical precautions that were taken, so that you wouldn't get hooked?
Well, you can't prevent it, but, I didn't leave the hospital physically addicted. I just fell in love with the stuff when I got it in the hospital and eventually found it on the streets.
How did you kick?
Oh, it was really very simple. I got arrested and they strapped me down in solitary and I quit my habit.
So you kicked in prison?
Not prison, just a jail, county jail.
Still must have been pretty excruciating.
Well, it was very unpleasant.
Was anybody kind to you while you were there?
Yeah, nobody was unkind. Yeah, the system, of course, is a drag, but there was nobody was nasty to me or anything. And again, I just kind of have a way of finding the biggest, strongest murderer and becoming friends with him, and nobody bothers me.
Really? Is that the trick?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what's the technique?
I'm not sure. It's just some inner thing of survival that allows me to kind of smile the right smile and talk the right talk. I have a way of knowing what goes on inside of people, and I can appeal to that.
Is this something that you've done not only in prison but outside of prison, to kind of get the right protection?
Oh, well, not consciously always to get the protection, but to talk with people with their language about their life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes people comfortable, and they respond. They respond to you.
How did the publication of Last Exit to Brooklyn change your life?
Well, I guess the big thing, at least from my point of view, is that some money started to come in and I could just dedicate my life to drinking and other aspects of chemical warfare. And I finally drank myself to death and I found another way to live.
Excuse me, you found another way?
Another way to live. I finally drank as much as I could and I couldn't drink anymore and I ended up getting sober, and I just entered another phase of living.
How have you made a living in the past 25 years in addition to your books? You've also had jobs.
Oh, many jobs. I've worked in gift shops and gas stations and offices. A couple of years ago, I was on welfare. I was a single parent and had been sick for a few years. I couldn't work, so I was on welfare for a year. So I just, whatever I need to stay alive.
When you were working in gift shops or gas stations, would you often get recognized by people who knew your writing and wondered what you were doing there?
Not in this country. No.
Never.
Did you often wonder what you were doing there? Did you wonder why you had to be doing this?
Oh, absolutely. I wondered. As Riley used to say, what a revolting development this is. I don't know how I end up where I end up. It's remarkable.
Some bio of you says that you had written for the National Enquirer for a time. Is that right?
Well, I was working there. I didn't exactly write. They had a mail order thing for a while. And a friend of mine was the head of that, and he gave me a job kind of writing copy for, mail order, like underwear and stuff, that kind of. So.
Do you remember any of your copy?
Oh, ladies, this trico underwear. You know what I mean? I don't know. Things like that. I had that a few weeks, however long.
Well, in the past few years, one of the things you've done is tour with people like Henry Rollins of Black Flag, the hardcore group, and you perform with Lydia Lunch,
right,
who's a punk singer. What kind of affinity did you feel with them and they with you? I mean, they're a lot younger. They were part of punk rock.
Well, they sought me out, actually, and they had been reading my work. And I remember it was amazing, talking with Henry about it. He had read all the books and really understood them. And I just instantly liked the guy, for one thing. I met him a couple of years ago for the first time. He's an extremely bright, sharp young guy. And he has a huge heart. He also has a little confusion like the rest of us. And we hit it off very well. And so we did a few gigs in L.A. And then last March, we did a tour of Europe together. And it was terrific. I get to meet a whole new world of people that I never met before. Because most of the people that come to see Henry, and they're like under 30, those people, a lot of them in their teens. So I meet people that I would never have met except under those circumstances.
You've been teaching lately, right?
Yeah, except I don't really call it teaching. I have a fiction workshop in the graduate school at USC. And I go down there one night a week.
Mm-hmm. So when was the last time that you were either on welfare or working at a kind of job that you really didn't feel you belonged in, like, the gift shops and the gas stations?
Oh, a couple of years ago.
That recently?
Yeah. When I was working for a job that ended, I guess, in the end of 86 or 87. Yeah, the end of 87. So I guess since then I've just been home working, writing. Yeah.
You writing something now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And Hubert Selby Jr. is the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, and he was an advisor and has a cameo in the new movie version of the book, which just opened. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And let me ask you, should I have been calling you Cubby? I mean, do you still not like the name Hubert?
Oh, no. Now it's home. Now I like it.
Now you like it.
Yeah, but 50 years later.
Okay, well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Irish writer John Banville has written novels about the astronomers Kepler and Copernicus, and he's written a new novel about a gentleman killer. Coming up, John Banville tells us what the three have in common. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two works by Kurt Weill. Both were originally written and performed for radio, and both have been released on record for the first time. And we have a couple of poems from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Peace talks in South Africa between the white government of F.W. de Klerk and the African National Congress led by Nelson Mandela concluded in an agreement that could end hostilities. NPR's John Madison reports from Cape Town.
President F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela came out of the talks to present a joint communique. De Klerk called it a breakthrough, and Mandela said South Africa was the winner. The two sides had sat for 3 days getting to know each other. From participants, it emerged that the atmosphere was extremely friendly with a minimum of conflict. Agreement was reached to settle the questions of the release of political prisoners, the return of exiles, and the removal of the state of emergency and other security legislation. But the biggest breakthrough was on the question of violence. Mandela promised to go back to his executive in exile to settle the question of its ongoing armed struggle against the government. This was widely interpreted as meaning he plans to seek approval for a decision to suspend all violent actions so the negotiations can proceed. I'm John Madison in Cape Town.
Members of the Kent State University community and visitors to the campus gathered today to dedicate a memorial to the events of May 4, 1970, when four students were killed and nine wounded by National Guardsmen. Roy Jones of member station WKSU reports.
An intermittent rain fell as former U.S. Senator George McGovern, university administrators, state and federal officials, and representatives of the slain and injured students formally dedicated the May 4th memorial. One of the emotional high points of the proceedings came as Ohio Governor Richard Celeste offered an apology to each of the students and their families.
And to all of those who were wounded, and to all of those who suffered 20 years ago today on this campus, I am sorry.
The victims and their families received a letter from then-Governor Rhodes and the Commandant of the Ohio National Guard expressing regret for the shooting as part of a court-mediated settlement in 1978. But Celeste's statement today was the first direct and personal apology for the Kent State incident from any high state official. For National Public Radio, I'm Roy Jones in Kent, Ohio.
Latvia declared its independence from the Soviet Union today. It's the third Baltic republic to move towards separation from Moscow. Lithuania and Estonia have already voted to break with the USSR. Latvia's parliament voted 138-0 in favor of independence. 57 ethnic Russian deputies boycotted the vote. Latvians make up slightly more than 50% of the republic's population, Russians about 30%. The remainder is divided among several nationalities. Latvia's Nationalist Popular Front Party said it will avoid confrontational tactics with the Soviet Union, and today's declaration provides an unspecified transition period for independence. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 14 points to close at 2710.19. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. 1990 marks the 90th anniversary of the birth of Kurt Weill and the 40th anniversary of his death. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of two works which Weill wrote for radio, works that have never been released before.
One of the foundations of the famous collaboration between Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht was the idea that music should have a larger audience than it could reach in a concert hall or opera house. In the late 1920s, the brand new medium of radio, for example, could provide this kind of mass audience. Two of Brecht and Weill's least known works were radio cantatas. The 1975 recording by David Atherton of their first work for the radio, the powerful Berlin Requiem, has just been added to the superbly produced Weill CD reissue series on Polydor. Last year, the Capriccio label released the first recording of Weill's one-act opera, The Tsar Has His Photograph Taken. Now Capriccio has issued the first commercial recording of two radio cantatas by Weill, Der Lindbergh-Flug, The Lindbergh Flight, and The Ballad of Magna Carta. On all of these, the Cologne Radio Orchestra is expertly conducted by Jan Latham Koenig. The Lindbergh Flight is exactly what it says it's about, the heroic transatlantic crossing by Charles Lindbergh in his single-engine Spirit of St. Louis, or, as it's called in German, Geist von St. Louis.
Mein Name ist belanglos. Ich bin 25 Jahre alt. Mein Großvater war Schwede. Ich bin Amerikaner. Meinen Apparat hab ich selber ausgesucht. Er fliegt 210 Kilometer in der Stunde. Sein Name ist Geist von St. Louis.
Brecht's libretto makes no attempt to be realistic. Lindbergh, portrayed by a tenor, sings his story in a formal, presentational style. Allegorical figures like fog, sleep, a snowstorm, and even the city of New York present their opinions and attitudes. Here's the seductive passage where sleep tries to persuade Lindbergh to rest. In the spirit of collaboration, the composer Paul Hindemith also contributed some music to the original version of the Lindbergh Flight. Later, Weill replaced the Hindemith sections with his own. Along with Weill's complete version, Capriccio has included on the same disc an extraordinary historic radio broadcast from March 18, 1930, of the first version of the cantata, with Hermann Scherchen conducting the Berlin Radio Orchestra. Here's a fascinating bit of the same sleep passage as it was originally composed by Hindemith. Maybe you can hear why Weill would want to do it all himself. The Ballad of Magna Carta was written for American radio in 1940. The text was by Maxwell Anderson, Weill's most frequent collaborator in America. Anderson had already written the book and lyrics for Knickerbocker Holiday, the show that September Song is from, and Weill's first big Broadway hit. The didactic Ballad of Magna Carta tells of King John's oppression of the British barons, the poor, and the Jews. It pointedly celebrates the principles of American liberty and resistance to tyranny nearly 2 years before we entered World War II. Musically, its range is wider, if not deeper, than the Lindbergh Flight. Weill certainly gets into the American idiom.
Right of kings to take away our land. He signed away the
I love the idea of an important composer writing music on contemporary issues for the radio. How many composers or radio stations today are willing to pick up that gauntlet?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Radio Cantatas by Kurt Weill on the Capriccio label. This is Fresh Air. John Banville's novel, The Book of Evidence, takes place in the mind of a murderer. Freddie Montgomery is a scientist and cultured gentleman who prides himself on his love of beauty and his appreciation of language. But he gets into debt, steals a painting to get some cash, and murders a maid during the getaway. In prison, awaiting his trial, he requests a dictionary and writes a long, flowery confession, which is the novel. The Book of Evidence is John Banville's eighth novel. Banville lives in Dublin, and he's the literary editor of the Irish Times. I asked Banville to read part of Freddie's description of prison life.
I confess I had hopelessly romantic expectations of how things would be in here. Somehow I pictured myself a sort of celebrity, kept apart from the other prisoners in a special wing, where I would receive parties of grave, important people and hold forth to them about the great issues of the day, impressing the men and charming the ladies. What insight they would cry, what breath! We were told you were a beast, cold-blooded, cruel, but now that we have seen you, have heard you, why... And there am I, striking an elegant pose, my ascetic profile lifted to the light in the barred window, fingering a scented handkerchief and faintly smirking, Jean-Jacques, the cultured killer.
Well, he really wants to be the cultured killer. Why did you choose as the character for your book someone who is very educated, very intelligent, very good with words, but a madman?
At one point I was going to use as an epigraph to the book that wonderful line from Nabokov's Lolita where he says you can always...
For a fancy prose style, yes.
You can always depend on a murderer for a fancy prose style. But I was already worried that people would... be too much reminded of Lolita, so I decided to leave that out. But I have a few nods of acknowledgement to Nabokov in the book, anyway.
Well, that's one of my favorite lines from Lolita. You can always count on a murderer for fancy prose style. And I kept thinking about that reading your book. And, I mean, do you think it's true?
I somehow doubt it. I like the idea of my killer, Freddie Montgomery, seeing himself as a something of a gentleman, very elegant, very poised. But of course the mask slips every now and then and we see behind it a man trapped inside himself. I don't think that he's mad. In a way I wish I did, but I really don't think that he's mad. I think he is crazed by what he has done, and I think he's crazed by a world that he dislikes intensely and finds difficult to manage, but I don't think he's clinically insane. I think that's what makes him more frightening than if he were mad.
A couple of your previous novels, one about, they're both about scientists, Kepler and Copernicus, and these novels are in part about the isolation and loneliness of genius, you know, of great men. Whereas your new book is kind of about the isolation and loneliness of a murderer.
I never thought of Copernicus and Kepler as great men when I was writing about them. I mean, I agree they are, but I never thought of them that way. They were obsessives, obsessed with what Wallace Stevens called the rage for order, to find some order to impose on a chaotic world. In that sense, the man in the Book of Evidence is very like them. He detests the world. He finds it a hideous place, very beautiful place, heartbreakingly beautiful, but the people keep getting in the way. and in a way, the person that he kills is someone who got in his way at precisely the wrong moment. She is the only character in the book who is not described, and he describes everybody else and everything else. I mean, Freddie can't pass by a stone on the road, but he has to try to make you feel what it looked like and how it felt to hold a stone. And he does the same with his people, but not the woman that he kills. She is, she's anonymous. And it's at the end of the book that he comes to the realization that his real crime is not so much killing the woman, that's the one that he'd be put in jail for, but his real moral crime is a failure of imagination, the failure to imagine the woman vividly and strongly enough to make her be there so that he wouldn't be able to kill her, as we see throughout history. It's only when you dehumanize people and don't imagine them vividly enough, imagine their situation and imagine yourself in their situation, that you find it easy to kill. So Freddie, at the end, thinks that his task now is to imagine a life for this woman. He describes himself as being mm-hmm. pregnant, living for two. But I think also what he doesn't remark on is the fact that what he has produced is a kind of act of atonement in producing a work of art. I mean, behind the book always there is the question of art and the question of how art can redeem things.
Because this confession, which your book is, it's his The Murderer's Long Confession, is really more like a novel in progress. Because he's constantly revising the characters in it, saying, she was tall and fat. Nope, she was short and skinny.
Yes, he certainly is producing a work of art. But this leads to, of course, to further ambiguities, because we say to ourselves, well, Freddie may be dreadful, and he may be a killer, and he may be all these things, but at least he's honest. At least he's telling us the unvarnished truth. Suddenly, we get the awful notion that he may have been lying. If he has lied at all, then it throws everything into doubt, and it makes him a far more evil character than he already is. Because, as I say, his one possibility of redemption is that he will be honest. He will be honest with the honesty of art.
You are the literary editor of the Irish Times, so I feel comfortable asking you this question. If you have a sense of where you fit in Irish literature, contemporary Irish literature.
Well, in a way, of course, everybody hopes that they're absolutely individual and that they don't fit in anywhere. If I were to say that I follow anyone, I suppose it would be Beckett. I was very pleased and honored to know that the last thing Beckett was reading before he died was the Book of Evidence. And I feel there's a sort of a symbolism in that's almost trite, but that I rather like, because I feel that I'm not comparing myself to him in stature. I'm simply, you know, answering your question about my place in the tradition, as it were. And I do like the notion of sort of the baton being handed on from Beckett to people like me. I don't really think that there is a tradition of the novel in Ireland. We had very great figures such as Joyce and Beckett, but there isn't a sort of tradition in the way that there is, for instance, in England, where the 19th century tradition is still going along quite strongly with people like Margaret Drabble and so on. That we don't have that in Ireland and never really had. So that people like myself who do work exclusively in the novel do feel themselves to be isolated. And in our better moments, we think of it as splendid isolation, you know.
Why do you think that that's true, that there hasn't been more of a literary tradition? Of course, the two people you mentioned, Joyce and Beckett, are people who really challenge the traditions of the novel anyways.
Well, I think one reason that there isn't a tradition in Ireland is that precisely because we had these enormously powerful figures. I mean, we had Shaw, Yeats, Oscar Wilde, Joyce, Beckett, and, you know, the list is very long indeed. And they intimidate us. I mean, they stand behind us like Easter Island statues, you know, this huge, shadowy, father-like, stony figure standing behind us. And we find it hard to get around them.
As the literary editor for the Irish Times, I imagine you have to assign who's going to review which books.
Yes, I do.
It strikes me that would be a really hard job in Ireland because it's such a small country. I figure most writers know each other, and it might be really difficult to find a writer who's not already friends or enemies with the writer of the novel about to be reviewed.
Yes, it's a very delicate position indeed. What I do for the most part is I try to send Irish books abroad, try to get people from Britain or from America to review them, so that there won't be this internecine warfare. But that's not always possible. One simply has to know who is friends with whom and who's, even more important, who's enemies with whom, and just hope for the best. But it is a delicate task, yes.
When the Book of Evidence came out in Ireland, in the Irish newspapers, was the book reviewed by writers from England and America instead of Ireland?
No, I did a very clever thing. I sent it to an academic friend of mine whom I knew would write a review that would be practically impenetrable so that people wouldn't know whether he was for it or against it. And it worked. It worked. So I felt justified.
I can't believe, though, that you let yourself assign who was going to review your own book.
Well, who else was going to do it?
You get a substitute to fill in for you.
Oh, no. Good Lord, no.
Really?
No.
You don't think that's a conflict of interest?
Yes, I suppose it is, yes. But people trusted me to do the right thing, and I did.
So did the person like the book or not? Could you tell?
I think he did, but it was really hard to tell. Anyway, it was a small review.
Well, John Banville, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Banville's new novel is called The Book of Evidence. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing news of the Soviet Republic of Latvia declaring its independence. It is the third of the three Baltic republics to do so. It happened on a day when the Prime Minister of Lithuania, which has already declared its independence, was visiting and speaking in Washington, D.C. We'll also hear about President Bush's speech on Europe that he made to graduation ceremonies in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and news of the spear fishing season ending. That's of importance to the Chippewa Indians. It's been the subject of a dispute. And also, news of the musical instrument that has been declared the official instrument of the city of San Francisco.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mark Halliday has a couple of his poems to read for us. The first is about how time and people move through our lives.
64 Elm Grove. I was there. That was me. There I was in the gray light. That day slipped like a raft on the Susquehanna, like a raft on the Shenandoah, sliding a little sideways like an old raft of worn boards on the Housatonic. At the kitchen sink I stood seeing yellow-brown grass matted in the backyard of 64 Elm Grove, and time passed. Jessica traveled emphatically down the hall in her boots, defying various fears. Happiness turned on its old famous wheel till odd silence and sad little touches took its place. There was that tangle of wet colors in the autumn yard, and then I was gone. Jessica was long gone, and my U-Haul truck trembled with fear of change. I am not at all a Hindu. I've never been a Hindu. I want to keep things. What I can't lose is the feeling that things are taken away because I haven't understood the right way to hold them close. If you love me, Jessica said, you have to let me grow. And I guess I did. And there was gray light in the kitchen. On the round table there were white coffee mugs till the whole house floated fast down river, till I stand now staring as if through a kitchen window at yellow-brown grass, as if staring could reassemble what was tangled and then became a runaway raft so easily, as if the white mugs and the piano and the wine-stained rug and how Jessica walked had not been worth keeping. I'm often troubled by the feeling of life being too big in the present, too many lives being led around me. Here's a poem in which I try to console myself about that by reminding myself that the same thing must have been true for someone living 60 years ago. Already in 1927. Summer night in quiet, level suburban streets. Lights still on in 2 out of 3 houses. 5 small green lights edge the driveway of a brick house 2 doors down. Cold lights in the warm, dark air. Hundreds of lives within 3 blocks. Persons who look away. And this is only one modest suburb in North Carolina or Connecticut. Too many persons who are looking away from you. But what about 1927? Then, too, lamps burned in thousands of windows within a few miles and were seen through the thick of summer night, meaning lives, averted, oblivious, unreachable. A boy and a girl said goodnight at the door, and from her window she watched him walk away into the ripe darkness of June 1927. She felt his steps leading to a city job and other girls, girls with expensive hats. She felt so small, lost, and so small. She sat in her bed for 20 minutes. Then she tied a paisley kerchief in her hair and washed her face and read a novel by Hardy and grew up and married a partly good man. She survived the infinity of 1927. Since already in 1927 the problem was present with all ingredients, the steps fading, lamplight cold in the warm air on this block and the next block. So, it's an old condition. The liquid darkness and voices from the far side of the playground, newspaper on the Davenport filled with unromantic activity, what Coolidge said about aid to farmers. Already in 1927, you had to pass through squares of darkness and small circles of yellow light, alone. My father, for instance, was 13. He shut the back door and climbed the creaky stairs, making plans.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with rhythm and blues star Johnny Otis. And we meet novelist Sue Miller. The author of The Good Mother has a new book that's also about a family. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.